That spirit of hospitality, of welcoming, of understanding, of acknowledging someone who may have been unwanted elsewhere, that they're welcome here with us.
Welcoming the stranger in the spirit of hospitality, the work Catholic organizations continue to do to help Afghan refugees in the U.S. as we mark 2 years since the U.S. withdrawal.
School is going as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
A small sense of normalcy after devastating wildfires. In a humble setting, school starts again.
I was in one village where it was destroyed by bombing, and one woman said to me that they received help and support from us.
And the tireless works of nuns who are providing care for single mothers amid the chaos and uncertainty of war. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Remembering the victims of the September 11th attacks. This week marks 22 years since the nearly 3,000 people were killed when hijacked planes were flown into the World Trade Center in New York City, the Pentagon near Washington, D.C., and when United Airlines Flight 93 crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The attacks changed the course of our nation, the lives of Americans and those around the world. Less than 1 month after those attacks, the United States launched Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan after the Taliban refused to hand over al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. On August 30th, just 2 weeks ago, we marked 2 years since the chaotic U.S. military withdrawal from the war in Afghanistan. During the withdrawal, 13 service members lost their lives in a terrorist explosion at the Kabul airport as they worked nonstop to help people escape. These were the last Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice during America's longest war. For more than 20 years, American troops and their allies fought and died there. More than 100,000 Afghan refugees were evacuated to various countries during the withdrawal. Many came to the United States, where they've had the opportunity to live in peace, free from the Taliban who took over the Afghan government. But it has not been an easy road for many, as they've sought work, housing, and a new life in a new culture. 2 years since their evacuation from their homeland, Mark Irons shares the journey of two Afghan families who are building success stories.
Helping customers, bagging groceries, organizing shelves. For one man, it's the stuff dreams are made of.
I'm very happy for this.
With the help of a business partner, Mohammed built this store from the ground up, laying floor tile, filling each aisle with produce.
Different kind of rice we have here.
And prioritizing customer needs.
Every product here is high quality because the people know the quality and the price. If the price is high, they will not come.
His supermarket in Fredericksburg, Virginia has only been open for about 2 months.
But the fact that Mohammed successfully started this business is pretty incredible when you consider what he, his wife, and six children left behind just 2 years ago.
Their country in chaos. In 2021, along with more than 100,000 refugees, Mohammed and his family evacuated Afghanistan. In August, the U.S. ended a 20-year war on terrorism there, and the last of U.S. troops withdrew from the country. But their exit didn't come with a victory parade. Many Afghans had supported the U.S. fight, and fear and frantic uncertainty surfaced among the people. Their government was collapsing around them, with the Taliban recapturing control. The U.S. began airlifting Afghan allies out of the country, offering them safety in America.
They can start new lives. They can start new occupations. They're able to find new ways.
Kathleen Renfro has welcomed many Afghans to the U.S. She works with a branch of Catholic Charities in Virginia focused on resettling the refugees. In all of them, she encounters a spirit of survival.
They know that they have arrived with nothing, so they have no more to lose.
As Mohammed worked to start his business, Catholic Charities helped his family find a place to live. With his home country still facing instability, insecurity, and Taliban rule, he didn't want to share his last name with us. And the Niazi family felt it best not to show their faces.
The mother says it was terrifying evacuating Afghanistan, and her family was afraid of what Taliban forces might do. She sits with two of her teenage daughters. Since arriving, the eldest has learned English, and she isn't looking back.
I don't want to go back to Afghanistan. I have so bad memories of there, so I will never go.
In America, she is most grateful for high school. In Afghanistan, under Taliban rule, girls aren't allowed to go to school.
That's why I don't want to go back. I want to continue my education here, get my job.
She hopes to become a computer programmer. Her younger sister wants to be a doctor so she can help others. Another girl in the Niazi family has spina bifida, and Catholic Charities assisted.
We were able to immediately get engaged, recognizing that they needed medical care.
But for all the Afghan families receiving support throughout America, many are still struggling, and their future remains unclear, with no assurance from the U.S. government that they can stay in the country long term. This is a concern of Bishop Mark Seitz, chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration. In a letter to Congress, he wrote, "Over 85% of those evacuated remain dependent on humanitarian parole or other temporary protections, and the vast majority are unlikely to attain asylum or special immigrant status. This is untenable." Bishop Seitz wants Congress to pass the Afghan Adjustment Act and help many of the same Afghans or their family members who served alongside U.S. service members. He says passing the act would be a moral imperative, demonstrating the United States' commitment to its allies and reaffirming the importance of humanitarian protection. The call from Bishop Seitz to support refugees is nothing new. It's something Catholics have historically fought for in the U.S.
The Catholic Church has been at the forefront of providing welcome.
Catherine Clifton works with Migration and Refugee Services in the U.S. Bishops' Conference. The effort to welcome the stranger means helping people of all backgrounds and faiths.
So many people I speak with who do this work say, look, it's not because they're Catholic, it's because we are, right? It's because of our own faith that we've stepped forward, and they've resettled people of all different faiths.
The faith most common among Afghan refugees is Islam. For Kathleen Renfro, a Catholic, helping Muslims has been a powerful experience. She's found similarities, including a shared reverence among Catholics and Muslims for the Virgin Mary. And through her work of service, Renfro says her life has changed.
I'd never believe in a million years that a Muslim family would bring me so much closer to my own faith, but that's exactly what they did.
Inside Mohammed's supermarket, you'll find a mix of items on the store shelves side by side. You'll find things supplied by most American grocery stores and others that offer a taste of home.
Here is, we have all dry fruit. They are coming from Afghanistan. All is natural.
Everything is made fresh here, is that right?
Yes.
He says the bakery is the most popular part of the store. When we visited in the afternoon, the bread baked that morning was long gone.
There's none here because everybody's been buying it.
Yeah, already we sold out this one because we have a lot of customers. They are coming from very far.
His new business can cater to migrants who have come from afar. But he says this isn't an Afghan supermarket. It's a store open to all, and he's happy Americans have accepted it as well.
They are coming and buying everything, and they like our store and our customer service, everything, so it is exciting.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Of the many individual Catholic Charities agencies around the country, one resettled more Afghan refugees in the United States than any other. We're joined by the executive director of that group, Patrick Raglow, from the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. Thank you so much for joining us, Patrick. Why Oklahoma City? Tell us how many Afghan refugees your Catholic Charities agency has helped and why your organization was in a position to do that.
Thank you for this opportunity, and thanks to all at EWTN for continuing to pay attention to the needs and opportunities that are present to our Afghan arrivals. Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City is a relatively small agency in the middle of the country. I don't know that we brought in more Afghan arrivals than any other resettlement partner in the country, but we certainly did more for any in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, so the largest number through the Catholic Charities Network. And our agency at the time was the only resettlement agency in the state of Oklahoma City for reception and placement, and we received 1,800 arrivals in two cities in 6 months. It was an amazing effort. Prior to that, we had resettled 21 arrivals in two cities in 12 months. But Oklahoma City does disasters wildfires and tornadoes and floods all the time. So we knew that we had the ability, if we treated it like a disaster response and not as a production pipeline problem, that we would lean into our community and we'd be able to get this job done. And it's been a really a hard job. It's an ongoing and still difficult job, but it's also been a front row seat to majesty. It's been beautiful.
And one that you have a heart for. You're a fan of something that's known as long-term recovery case management. Tell us what that means and how you're implementing that with the resettled Afghans.
Well, thank you. So there are folks that show up. I mean, they're called first responders for a reason. So something happens and they are the first responders. But oftentimes after the initial attention goes away and the initial food and shelter are taken care of, they still got to go through a long journey of recovery to respond after a disaster. And so in the 2013 series of tornadoes that affected 8,000 households, Your Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City was working with those survivors for 5.5 years. And so not everyone took 5.5 years, but the most difficult cases took that much time to process. And so it'll be the same for many of these arrivals. The formal processes of reception and placement, 90 days for the first phase, up to 5 years for the second phase, but not everyone will use all those 5 years. But it's important to be with them for that journey so that they can actually launch and thrive and then contribute to our economy, to our community, to our livelihood, and to us generally.
Now, many Afghans are doing well through that first response with jobs, apartments, cars, and children enrolled in school. What do you see as the biggest challenges they still face moving forward?
Well, the biggest challenge in Oklahoma remains accessible, affordable housing. Mm. You know, especially when you have large family sizes, 11, 12, 14, 16 people in the family, usually one breadwinner. And initially, they're making $15 an hour or so. And so it's really, really hard to find an affordable place to live, to put 3 or 4 bedrooms and to have your family survive and thrive and do all of those things that you want your family to do on $15 an hour. So affordable housing is and has been the hardest of the efforts that we have. Now, there are still also some that are dealing with post-traumatic stress. There are many that are having medical issues. There are also those that are very concerned about their employment authorization documents and their ability to stay because the federal processes are clogged and taking a very long time to keep up with allowing them to be here lawfully and to work lawfully.
Well, Catholic Charities couldn't do this alone, especially the issues, the legal issues surrounding this. Can you tell us about some of your partners on this refugee resettlement mission?
That's absolutely right. And thank you for asking. We could not have done this on our own. We're a relatively small agency with 65 staff. We ramped up in 90 days to 105 staff. And so about 40 people that we added to the agency. But we leaned into more than 80 congregations, parishes, and denominations of every flavor, Catholic, non-Catholic, Christian, evangelical, secular, Jewish, Muslim, all this community wrapped around these families in a way that ought to be an example all around the world for how we can come together to serve the common good, each from our own faith tradition, each from our own need, recognizing the other as brother and sister and doing all of that. So we, you know, it's an amazing thing. 80 different congregations and denominations in Oklahoma City and a similar number in Tulsa that just leaned in to help this group arrive and thrive.
That's a beautiful show of community gathering to help the stranger coming in. Now, as we were having a preliminary conversation with you while we were scheduling this interview, you talked about the importance of the smiling face of the Statue of Liberty. Bring our viewers into that discussion.
Well, you know, if we do this work right, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the only way Catholic Charities does it, that it is literally the face of the Statue of Liberty smiling. And it's not only of benefit to those whom we are helping. As in all acts of mercy and all acts of grace, it is a delicious dependency that we are called by our gospel message, that we rely on them when we need help, and they rely on us when they need help. And when we are helping them, we benefit. And when they help us, they benefit. And so when we bring this beautiful mission together with refugee resettlement, it is literally the face of the Statue of Liberty smiling, because we are able to help these folks. We get them to see and learn and know Oklahoma, the land of second, third, and last chances. It's a beautiful place, and they're thriving and they're growing, and it's still hard and it's beautiful. But we have also gained, and they're going to contribute to our economy, to our culture, to our schools, to our community for decades. And so when we do these things, when we act out the corporal works of mercy with the gospel mission, everybody benefits, and it's a virtuous positive cycle, and it's beautiful to watch.
It's certainly heroic work. Yes, exactly. It is hard. Well, thank you so much for the work that you do and for your service to our country.
Thank you.
And big news this week about another immigration matter related to immigrants already in the United States. A federal judge on Wednesday declared a revised version of DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, illegal. DACA is a policy that prevents the deportation of hundreds of thousands of immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. A U.S. district judge agreed with Texas and eight other states suing to stop the program. It's the latest twist in a five-year-long court battle that has left DACA and its recipients, known as Dreamers, in limbo. The ruling is expected to be appealed. Ultimately, its fate will likely be decided by the Supreme Court. The week's top headlines when we return, including devastating natural disasters that have taken thousands of lives, a controversial U.S. deal with Iran, and a meeting of world leaders for the G20 summit. We'll be right back.
They're starting to get very anxious about where they're going to live.
A month after fires took their homes, those living on Hawaii still live in a state of uncertainty. The Bishop of Honolulu gives us an update. And still to come, a Catholic first, the remarkable beatification of martyrdom.
A humanitarian crisis in Libya tops the week in review. Raging floodwaters hit the desert nation, which was unprepared to handle such a disaster. The death toll has risen to more than 6,000 people, with thousands more missing after torrential downpours caused two dams to collapse near the northern coastal city of Derna. Authorities say many people may have been swept out to sea or buried beneath rubble. After years of war and political strife, Libya's infrastructure, like the dams, has been neglected and poorly maintained. And government dysfunction has complicated rescue and relief efforts. The flooding appears to be one of the deadliest on record in North Africa, caused by a rare hurricane-like storm in the Mediterranean Sea. Hope is fading in Morocco, where rescue and relief workers continue to dig through the wreckage in a desperate effort to find survivors of a devastating 6.8 magnitude earthquake that rocked the country last Friday. The quake demolished entire villages. The death toll has reached 3,000, with numbers rising by the hour.
It happened in a flash. My father-in-law was in the room upstairs, while my husband was sleeping downstairs. When the quake struck, both of them died instantly. It's God's will.
Relief efforts have stepped up after the Moroccan government was criticized for initially saying it would only accept help from what it called friendly countries. But the situation remains especially dire in remote areas, nearly inaccessible because of single-lane roadways and rock slides. Hundreds of thousands are now homeless with winter temperatures approaching.
Desidero esprimere la mia vicinanza al caro popolo del Marocco.
Pope Francis expressed his sympathy this week for both the earthquake victims in Morocco and flood victims in Libya. Calling for prayers for those suffering, the Holy Father said he hoped the world will support those in need with concrete aid and assistance. It's been a little more than a month since deadly wildfires tore through Maui. A small glimmer of hope is that the list of people now missing has dropped down from hundreds to 66. The official death toll remains at 115 people. Those lucky enough to survive the wildfires that decimated the town of Lahaina and surrounding areas are still coming to grips with the losses they have suffered. We first spoke with Bishop Larry Silva of the Diocese of Honolulu about the fires last month and talked to him again this week about what he is seeing and hearing from the faithful trying to recover.
They are, of course, still grieving, still lost in terms of where they will go in the future, where they'll be housed. They're, of course, trying to deal with FEMA and insurance companies and, you know, the government agencies and other agencies that are trying to help. But it's a very complex thing. So your prayers and your support are very much needed. I will say that Sacred Hearts School, which operated there in Lahaina at Maria Lanakila Parish, is open again, and it's operating again. It's been open a couple of weeks now. They're in very makeshift quarters. They are accepting students, and they have students there with them. So that's a great sign of hope.
Only rubble and ash was left of the original Sacred Heart School, which provided education for about 200 students. Right now, there are about 100 children who have returned to the makeshift quarters that have been set up on lanais and patios. If you would like to help the relief efforts on Maui, Bishop Silva says you can visit this website, tinyurl.com/Maui Catholic. Leaders from nations with the world's largest economies gathered last weekend for the G20 summit in New Delhi, India. Hosted this year by Indian Prime Minister Modi, the annual summit provides a forum for discussing trade and economics, as well as pressing global issues. Avoiding potential conflict among member states, this year the G20 endorsed a consensus declaration that countries cannot seize territory by force, recognized the suffering of the people of Ukraine, but did not directly criticize Russia. It was much toned down from last year when the G20 condemned Russia and demanded it withdraw from Ukraine. The leaders also announced a project to create a rail and shipping corridor linking India, the Middle East, and eventually Europe. A U.S. deal with Iran is sparking controversy as the Biden administration has authorized a waiver to release billions of dollars of frozen Iranian assets to secure the release of 5 American citizens detained in Iran. The deal marks a major breakthrough for the longtime adversaries, who remain at odds over the expansion of Iran's nuclear program and its military support for Russia. But it faces harsh criticism from Republicans in Congress who oppose any agreement on freezing Iranian funds. The money has been held in South Korea, will be transferred to Qatar, and will be released to Iran only for the purchase of humanitarian goods.
Getting Americans home requires decisions, sometimes really tough decisions. It requires compromise. It requires negotiations. It requires negotiations with people you really would rather not be sitting across the table from. But you got to do it, because Americans overseas in trouble, wrongfully detained, need to know, and their families need to know, that this president and this administration will do what it takes to bring them home.
Critics of the deal say unfreezing the funds creates an incentive for America's adversaries to conduct future hostage taking. It remains unclear when the prisoner transfer might take place, but it comes as both President Biden and the president of Iran prepare to travel to next week's United Nations General Assembly in New York. A newly released report in Switzerland has found more than 1,000 cases of sexual abuse by priests and others since the mid-20th century. The year-long study commissioned by the Swiss Conference of Bishops documents 510 accused and 921 victims. The report indicated most victims were male, 56%, and 74% of the victims were minors. Most of the accused were men. The study also indicates that many cases were deliberately concealed or minimized. The research team also noted that this is the tip of the iceberg, as more archives are yet to be evaluated. And just weeks before Roman Catholic bishops head to the Vatican for the upcoming Synod on Synodality, the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, the largest of the 23 Eastern Catholic churches in communion with Rome, wrapped up their own synod this week. The theme, pastoral support for victims of war. 45 of 56 bishops of this Byzantine rite participated. Eastern churches are governed by these synods, during which time they can discuss the direction their church is headed and elect new bishops. The current head of the church, Major Archbishop Sviatoslav Shevchuk, thanked the Pope and Catholics for standing with Ukraine during this time of war. 4.3 million people belong to this church. Most of them live in Ukraine, Poland, North and South America. Pope Francis will be traveling to the French city of Marseille at the end of next week to take part in the conclusion of the Mediterranean meetings. The meetings allow bishops from across the Mediterranean to gather and discuss solutions to challenges facing coastal Mediterranean communities, including immigration, economy, religious plurality, and more. The eight-day event also invites young people and all organizations or actors of goodwill to take part and promote positive initiatives throughout the region. The festival includes hikes, talks, Marian processions, roundtable discussions, and interreligious dialogue. It culminates with the attendance of Pope Francis. The Holy Father has repeatedly highlighted the plight of migrants, many of whom have died crossing the Mediterranean, and asked for the region to be a place of welcome for those seeking a better life. The Vatican opened the doors to one of Renaissance Rome's most spectacular palazzos on Tuesday. It's normally hidden from public view since it houses some of the Holy See's most secretive offices, the ecclesial tribunals that decide everything from marriage annulments to plenary indulgences. Built in the late 1400s on the ruins of a Paleo-Christian church, rooms are decorated with frescoes of cherubs, gilded ceiling panels, and more. Tourists even got to see a wood-paneled library where Napoleon Bonaparte kept the imperial archives during the early 1800s when Rome was the second capital of his empire.
It's true that some people are pushing this agenda.
Concerns about ideology at the Synod on Synodality related to the role of women. We look at contrasting visions of female leadership in the church. But first,
I feel that my faith grows and many people tell me about the experience of God's providence and care for them.
Stories of faith and hope in the face of war. Catholic nuns continue their work to help those in the peripheries despite the echoes of bullets and bombs surrounding them. One sister shares her story.
A rare foreign trip for North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. He met this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin to pledge full support of Russia in the midst of its war with Ukraine. Kim toured the Siberian Space Rocket Launch Center. It's believed North Korea is interested in gaining access to Russian technology for its satellite and nuclear programs. And Russia is interested in North Korea's large stockpile of dated artillery and rockets compatible with its weapon systems. An arms deal would ease Russia's high ammunition burn rate in Ukraine. All of these actions, if taken, would be in gross violation of United Nations sanctions. Meanwhile, the Vatican continued its efforts to bring peace in Ukraine. Cardinal Matteo Zuppi traveled to Beijing this week to meet with China's special envoy for Eurasian affairs. China has refrained from officially condemning the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. The Holy See's press office says the visit is another step of the mission to sustain humanitarian initiatives and seek paths toward peace. Zuppi has already visited Kyiv, Moscow, and Washington, D.C. A Ukrainian attack on a strategic shipyard in Russia-controlled Crimea wounded 23 people on Wednesday. It's one of the biggest attacks in recent weeks, damaging two ships and sparking a fire. Russia's defense ministry said Ukraine launched 10 cruise missiles and 3 sea drones. More than a year and a half of war has taken its toll. Throughout the chaos and destruction, a group of nuns has continued its work, tirelessly caring for single mothers and their children. Rizal Reja spoke with one of the sisters who explains the critical need their care provides.
This is the House of Hope single mother's home, run by nuns from Poland.
I'm Sister Camilla, and I'm from the Order of Sisters of Orionists. We, together with our community for 12 years, we're engaged in one house for single mothers in Ukraine near Kharkiv.
It was started by Sister Renata in 1996 as part of the Diocese of Kharkiv. She was later joined by 3 more nuns, one of them being Sister Camilla.
This is the project for single mothers and their children who experience some crisis, difficult situations, or homelessness. They can go to this house. Sometimes they're brought by police or a social worker. In this house, they can experience the help they need.
Sister Camilla explains that there are 2 programs available. The first program helps mothers and children with their basic needs, such as housing, clothing, and food. The second program helps mothers get their feet on the ground.
There is the second stage of the project, so if they need, they can rent a room in another house, so we can help them to work, and to start something good in their life.
The sisters not only provide a safe and stable home, they also teach mothers life skills for potential employment, such as housekeeping, sewing, and gardening. Sister Camilla says she especially loves helping mothers with newborns.
We bring the mother from the hospital, then we organize some things for them. We also try to help them by teaching them how to care for their child.
After 26 years of living peacefully in Korotich, their lives suddenly changed. War broke out in Ukraine in February 2022, and the sisters had to make plans to protect the mothers and the children. For 9 days, they hid in the basement of the houses, until their prayers were answered. Sisters from another order living at an old monastery in Yazlovets were willing to house them.
When war started, in our house, we have 17 mothers and about 30 children. After a few days, we had to evacuate our houses to western Ukraine.
For 4 days, they traveled 600 miles to safety. Months later, in September 2022, the sisters returned to Korotich.
We came back to our house after half a year, and then we started to continue our ministry. New mothers and their children came to us. At the moment, we have 10 mothers and 17 children.
With war still raging, schools are no longer in session. As a result, the sisters began providing education to school-age children.
During the war, this made it difficult for the children because they can't go to school. So we tried to organize them in school, have them continue learning, and help them have a good childhood.
The sisters tried to keep a sense of normalcy for the children, even though war is outside their doors.
20 or 30 kilometers from us, there were villages that were occupied with many destroyed houses. Sometimes you heard explosions near us, also a few bombs which touched our village. But it is not as dangerous as it was in the beginning of the war.
The House of Hope is really living up to its name. The sisters instill faith in the children so that despite the war, the children are hopeful for a better future. Since reestablishing the houses in Korotich, 4 refugee families have also joined them.
We experienced the war, and I want to say that God is with us. He cared for us and helps us and protected our lives, our freedom, and dignity.
Along with operating the House of Hope, the sisters have been assisting their diocesan Caritas agency in distributing humanitarian aid to about 4,500 people a week, roughly 10% of whom are children.
During this war, we received much help, especially humanitarian aid. This was an opportunity to help those in the area where we live.
Sister Camilla is very grateful for all the help and support they have been receiving, but her ultimate wish is for peace in her country.
Ukrainians still need prayers and other needs, and I hope the war will end and Ukraine will also experience peace. Because of this situation, what's very important is our faith and trust in God.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Sister Camilla was in Colorado earlier this month to spread awareness of the current situation in Ukraine and to share stories of the House of Hope. She, along with Director of EWTN Ukraine, Father Oleksandr Zelensky, and Bishop Vitaly Skomorovsky of Lutsk, were hosted by the Catholic Outreach to Neighbors in Ukraine, or KONU. The organization helps raise funds for Catholic organizations in Ukraine. KONU Vice President Ken Rackers explains that with the outbreak of war, they're hoping to fill a critical need.
We want to raise that awareness to continue our good work, to support the work that our partners do, which saves lives, which feeds people, which clothes people, which provides them basic services, because there are still millions of refugees who have lost their homes.
For more information or to offer your support, visit konuhome.org.
We have no real reason so far to consider that the doctrine will be at risk.
Real concerns or real hype? Questions raised that the upcoming October assembly of the Synod on Synodality could alter church teaching. Analysis coming up after the break. And still ahead, a national call for Our Blessed Mother's intercession. The upcoming event that you can take part in. We'll explain.
We're We're less than 1 month away from the first global assembly on the Synod on Synodality, the culmination of a multi-year global effort of listening to the Universal Church. The massive process that began in 2021 has already undergone the diocesan, national, and continental stages. Hundreds of clergy, including bishops, priests, religious, as well as laity from around the world, will be participating in the Synod on Synodality, or the 16th Ordinary General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops. Among those lay and religious are women. Some 83 women will be taking part in the Synod, 38 religious and 45 lay women. 54 women in all will be voting in the Synod. They will be comprised of 24 religious and 30 lay women. The role of women in the church is expected to be touched upon in the Synod on Synodality, but some critics are raising concerns about the upcoming assembly, asking whether it might lead to potential changes in church teaching on the role of women. I spoke with the Europe correspondent for our National Catholic Register, Solène Tadier, who has been following this issue closely, on what we can expect this October. Solène, you profiled the recent new female leaders, one of them, Mother Yvonne Rougonnat. What is her vision for female leadership at the Vatican and its purpose?
Yes, Mother Rougonnat, in some ways, is a symbol of Pope Francis's efforts during his pontificate to appoint more women to the decision-making positions, in continuity with his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. In terms of her vision of female leadership, she already reaffirmed in our 2019 interview for the National Catholic Register the importance of having different and distinct ministries in the church. And she emphasized also that women complement the hierarchy of the church in handling ecclesiastical affairs, not least because with their specific sensitivity, they see things in a unique way and they have distinct perceptions on humanity's inherent frailty, which helps a lot actually in tackling the most delicate issues. She therefore encourages a strong recommitment of women in the life of the church without being shy, without being, you know, with a very strong commitment, but without ever losing sight of this necessary complementary approach. And she has held the same position in all her public statements since then.
That approach, many women do want to discuss leadership at the Vatican, but they think that it needs to be done through the diaconate or opening up the ordination or the priesthood for women. What has your reporting shown about these recent appointments and whether it signals that any of that is true, or is it really Mother's vision that's true?
Indeed, there have been these demands in the background of the Synod reflection so far. Several theologians, organizations like Women's Ordination Conference are actively promoting these views. Yet these demands, I can say also that these demands were heard during the Continental Assemblies for the Synod last winter that I attended for the National Catholic Register in Prague. It was in February. And they were mainly put forward by Synod delegates from Germany, many of them were also part of the German Synodal Way. But this, I can say that it remains a relatively minority position in relation to the overall discussions and proposals. The Pope himself has already rejected these demands, and the women selected to take part in the Synod Assembly, in the Synodal Assembly in October, show no particular signs of changing course in this direction, at least for the time being. And Cardinal Hollerich, the general rapporteur of the Synod, during a press briefing in February, still in Prague, wanted to make it clear that it was not a synod on priesthood of women whatsoever, and that this would not be on the agenda for discussions.
Now, Solène, tell us a little bit about the recent history of this issue. What has Pope Francis done to listen to women? Is he able to change the diaconate?
In his various decisions, Pope Francis has shown his willingness to listen to women by giving them an increasing place at all levels of the church administrations. That's very clear. And it is also attested by a recent study published by Vatican News showing that in 2022, some 26% of the Vatican staff were all women, many of whom are also lay women, including economists, historians, archivists, secretaries, and they were only 19% in 2013. But regarding the female diaconate, the Pope has in fact created two commissions in 2016 and another one in 2020 with the mission to study the role of women deacons, especially with regards to the early days of the church. But they have so far not provided any additional guidance. But at the same time, in a letter sent to the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in 2021, the Holy Father reiterated his opposition to the idea of opening priesthoods and diaconates to women. And he precised that further thought should be given to non-ordained ministries. And it is interesting because Pope Benedict XVI raised the same issue in 2019 in his message for the anniversary of the International Theological Commission, suggesting that it needed to be clarified theologically. And again, in both cases, the female diaconate does not imply in any case opening up the ministry of deacons to women. This would be rather a lay ministry that would allow women to carry out tasks that would be analogous to those performed by deacons usually. And it is in this light that most experts interpret the synod document, which explicitly mentioned the need to reflect on the inclusion of women in the diaconate and the ways in which this could be achieved. But we should keep in mind that this term is to be understood as a non-ordained lay ministry and not a proper diaconate ministry.
That would have a path. That's right. That would have a path to the priesthood. So you're talking about two different things, a split in the definition of diaconate and also two popes both reaffirming that this really isn't the direction that they wanted for women. They did want to include women in leadership. So with all of that in mind, Solène, what does the vote now given to women in this synod mean? What can we expect its impact to be?
Of the 28, of the 85 women attending the synod, 54 have the right to vote. This means that they will be able to vote with all 374 voting members at the synod assembly on all the different issues that will be discussed. It will therefore be the first time that women and not consecrated lay people will be able to vote at a synod. And before that, this right was reserved for clerics. And so it is considered a very important change, together with the fact that the presence of two women among the nine president delegates will be also allowed. That is, two president delegates will preside over the synod assembly in the name and by authority of the Pope when he's not present. The aim of the synod leaders in including them, like more women and more young women, in the deliberative process is according to them to make the church more representative. But they precise that the people selected, especially according to the synod rapporteur, had to have they had to have participated in the synod process at national and continental level in order to ensure continuity and to stand out for their culture and knowledge about the church and their virtue of prudence, meaning that they should put the church before their personal interests.
Well, that's remarkable. We'll be watching that very carefully. Thank you so much, Solène.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
EWTN and all of our news entities, including our broadcasts, EWTN News Nightly, News in Depth, Pro-Life Weekly, as well as our print and digital entities of the National Catholic Register, the Catholic News Agency, ASI Prensa, and more, will be covering the Synod on Synodality from multiple angles. We will also have a daily live broadcast from Rome with up-to-the-minute news from this historic assembly. Be sure to follow us on air and online for complete coverage.
Allowing her to teach us through the Rosary how to ponder the mysteries of her Son.
To Jesus through Mary. Up next, the event that is calling Americans to gather at the largest Catholic church in North America. And it's not too late for you to join. Stay with us.
Our Lady entrusted the Rosary to the Dominican Order to shine the light of Jesus Christ throughout the world.
shining the light of Jesus one Hail Mary at a time. A national rosary pilgrimage in Washington, D.C. is calling all Catholics to dust off their beads and pray for our country and to grow closer to Christ through His Mother. Father Patrick Briscoe of the Dominican Friars and editor of Our Sunday Visitor will be one of those participating in what promises to be a beautiful celebration. Thanks for joining us again on EWTN News in Depth, Father Briscoe. The Dominicans are the keepers of the keys of the Rosary. The Blessed Mother gave it to St. Dominic. So this event really is at the heart of your order. Can you expand on that, please?
It truly is. So for hundreds of years, the Dominicans have been entrusted with preaching the Rosary in a very special way. And I think that a lot of people can tap its power right now today. The Rosary at its heart is a prayer fundamentally about Mary and about Jesus. Mary who leads us to Jesus. So our theme for the pilgrimage this year is actually to Jesus through Mary, because we know that with Mary as our guide, by meditating on the life of Jesus, by praying together the Rosary, we'll be led more deeply into the divine mysteries.
And there's nothing that our Lord would not do for His Mother. So this is a whole day event. What does the day look like leading up to the Rosary?
It is. It's going to be a fantastic day. There's all kinds of different opportunities that are available. So you can view the entire schedule online at rosarypilgrimage.org. But for just a sneak peek, we've got conferences that are being preached by Father Gregory Pine. Many people know him from Pints for Aquinas or the God's Planning podcast. We're going to have confession and Eucharistic adoration available. Some people say a rosary pilgrimage. Does that support or conflict with the bishop's call for the Eucharistic revival? Well, it supports it, right? We're going to gather for Eucharistic adoration. And then we're going to have a beautiful presentation of the Rosary that is a beautiful recitation of the Rosary, which will involve a procession of Dominican friars and a beautiful litany, which has been written from the occasion. So the music is going to be astonishing. And then the day will conclude with a vigil mass for Our Lady of the Rosary. So Dominicans have a custom of celebrating a mass for the Rosary on the first Sunday of October. We call it Rosary Sunday. So we'll even have a vigil mass for Rosary Sunday to conclude the day.
That's wonderful. Now, that's a lot of in-person events. If someone can't attend in person, how can they participate?
Absolutely. The whole day is going to be shared online. And we're hoping that people will join us because, again, the heart of this event is a call for people to band together in prayer, to pray for the church, to pray for our country, to pray for our loved ones who are maybe separated from the faith, and to entrust all of these intentions in a special way to the Blessed Virgin Mary, who we know her son listens to with a great love.
Now, you mentioned the Eucharistic Revival. You're also a Eucharistic preacher for the Eucharistic Revival that we're in the middle of right now in the United States. How is this event in concert with this movement in the church?
That's right. We want to stir up people's faith. We want to stir up people's faith. It's a great distress to priests, to the bishops of our country, to every devout Catholic when we hear more and more stories about people falling away. And they fall away for reasons that are hard to bear. So we need to give them reasons to have faith. And an event like this, a pilgrimage dedicated to the Rosary that has at its heart Eucharistic celebrations, both adoration and the Mass, is one expression of our Eucharistic faith. It's a revival of the kind of devotional program, which is for many Catholics the simple and steady expression of their faith.
Now, how is the love of our Mother expressed through this wonderful meditation, so important for such a time of division and confusion that we're living through right now?
Yeah, I think that is really what's driving this event and why people are responding. I mean, we've had incredible stories. We've had people writing to us from prisons asking for holy cards to join the novena that we led leading up to the day. We've had stories of people wanting to pray the Rosary for the first time because they heard about the Rosary pilgrimage, so they decided to pick up the prayer. I mean, I've heard stories of grandparents coming back to the practice of the faith because their children have been praying the Rosary Novena pilgrimage prayer in their grade school classrooms. I mean, so already we're hearing these extraordinary signs. And I really believe that's because Our Lady calms the tumult of our heart, that she, especially through the Rosary, which is a contemplative prayer, brings us the grace we need in order to experience the peace of her son.
That's so beautiful. Well, last question. A lot of people don't know how the Dominicans are organized. You're all over the country and around the world. Tell us a little bit about how you're present here in the United States.
Yeah, we don't know how we're organized either. But the great thing about the order is that unlike other religious orders that have various expressions of the charism of a founder, there's only one Dominican order throughout the whole world, which is a beautiful thing. So since the time of St. Dominic, we've stayed just one order, which is amazing. This event is sponsored by my province, which governs our region. Our region, the province of St. Joseph, extends from Maine as far south as Virginia and as far west as Ohio and Kentucky. So we're kind of the northeast province. But the other provinces are participating in this pilgrimage as well. Their rosary promoters are going to join us. And so the idea is that this is a model which can then be planted and expanded throughout the whole country. So we have a lot of enthusiasm about this project that we're hosting here in the Northeast, but that we hope inspires many similar events throughout the U.S.
Well, that's a beautiful thing to know, that all of the Dominicans are praying this together and are holding it in their hearts. Thank you so much, Father Briscoe.
Thank you again for having me on, Monsi.
Thank you. You still have time to sign up. Visit rosarypilgrimage.org to find out more about how you can join this call to prayer on September 30th. And a day of joy in Poland last weekend when, for the first time in modern history of the Catholic Church, an entire family was beatified together. Józef and Wiktoria Ulma and their 7 children were martyred during World War II for sheltering 2 Jewish families from the Nazis. Nazi patrol surrounded the Ulma home on March 24, 1944, on the outskirts of the village of Markowa in southeast Poland. They killed 32-year-old pregnant Wiktoria, her 44-year-old husband, and their 6 children, ranging in age from 1 to 7 years old. The 7th Ulma child to die was the couple's unnamed son, who was in the process of being born. It is thought that Wiktoria went into labor during the massacre as a witness reported seeing a newborn baby beside her body. The Nazis went on to kill the 8 Jews in hiding in the Ulma home. While the couple's unnamed newborn son was not baptized, he's considered baptized by blood through the martyrdom of his mother. While other families have been beatified in the history of the church, those beatifications took place individually, while the Ulma family was beatified together and are all martyrs. There are only similar situations in antiquity. You can read more about the Ulma family on our sister agency websites, including the Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register. And that does it for this week's episode of EWTN News In Depth. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week for more stories important to your Catholic faith. And if you want to rewatch this program or any segments, follow us on our Facebook, Twitter, now called X, Instagram, and the EWTN YouTube page. Like us and subscribe.